To the men and women who have served and are now serving in the United States Air Force, today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to them.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
And good morning and welcome once again to another Veterans Radio program. We're broadcasting right here from the Prairie House in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. Yeah, right. The heart of the Midwest. I know. There's a lot of good cities out here. But Ann Arbor is a very special place. And this has been our home for 6 years. We're here at WDEO. And terrestrially, and of course on veteransradio.net for our web, all coming to you from the Ave Maria Network. Boy, we got a program today. Our guest today has been on our program many, many times, and I'm so pleased to ask her to come in because she always does volunteer and is ready to give us another great program that we have, and so much information. We're going to be talking about North Korea. Yeah, what's going on there? What's going on in North Korea? Well, we're going to have Dr. Rebecca Grant and her response, the Air Force's response to that. Secondly, drones, my favorite subject, drones. We hardly know anything about it. Every time I ask somebody about drones, they go, Well, yeah, that's those things that kind of fly like a kite. No. There's much more to it. And we're going to get to the meat of that. The third issue is going to be, what did sequester do to the bomber fleet as far as funding? We got lots of questions. What about the F-35? That's right. That was in development. What about that? What about the B-52? What about the B-2 bombers? We're going to find out all about that in the Air Force's response to the sequester with Dr. Rebecca Grant, international consultant with the Air Force, and we'll be right back with that. Don't go away. You want to listen to this very important message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu. Or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And welcome once again to Veterans Radio here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, broadcasting out of the Prairie House, WDEO. Oh, we've got a program today. Once again, our guest on Veterans Radio, and she's been so kind to be up early in the morning. We talked about different teas to use because keeping that voice going for the next 50 minutes is really a challenge. But I know that Dr. Rebecca Grant, that's going to be our guest, president of IRS Independent Research. It's a firm specializing in defense and aerospace research for corporate and government clients. Dr. Grant was a member of the Secretary of Air Force Staff Group and the Air Force Chief of Staff's Operations Group, CCX, up until 1994. Since she founded the IRS Independent Research in 1995, she has focused on joint doctrine, air power history, and defense strategy, and boy, we're going to cover all those topics. Welcome once again to Veterans Radio, Dr. Grant. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob. It's great to be back on the program with you.
And is your tea ready?
I have my green tea with jasmine. How does that sound?
I have green tea with hibiscus. We ought to do just fine with all that vitamin C going out over the air. Folks, if you have a question for Dr. Grant, please give us a call at 877-573-7825. I got that right, Nina? 877-573-7825. Don't hesitate. Give us a call. No question is considered, nah, we don't do that. No, give us a call, and let's ask those questions today. Well, we're going to be talking, first of all, about North Korea. North Korea. I call it the Belgium of Asia. It's between China and Japan. Same thing happened to Belgium. They were between Germany and the Russians. What happened? Whoa. And now we've got that powder keg all the time. It gets a little old, actually, all this saber rattling. It seems to happen every time that the current leader, premier, president, dictator, Kim Jong-un, wants to announce something or wants something back from the West. Now, Dr. Grant, what about some of the things that are going on as far as the capability of North Korea to reach Japan with their missiles? They have test-fired a missile. They've also set off an atomic explosion. Where do we stand on this right now?
Well, it's a pretty dangerous road, Bob, and you're right to point that out. I think that what's different now in 2013 is we're looking at a track record of three fairly recent nuclear tests, first in 2006 and 2009, and then again just back in February. And that's what's really got the international community on edge, that and the fact that North Korea really is developing the longer-range missiles. They have missiles that can reach throughout that Pacific theater, targeting allies, as you mentioned, like Japan. And then, of course, we're also, they claim that they are working on missiles that can reach U.S. Sovereign territory, whether that's Guam or Alaska or potentially even Hawaiian Island chain or maybe even back here in the lower 48. So those are the very, very disturbing trends that we're seeing with North Korea at the moment.
Well, in the past, the Korean War that was fought from 1950 to 1953, June to July, June of 50 to July of 53, it was to, as far as the North was concerned, to reunify the North and the South that was divided after World War II. So this is not the issue. What's going on here? Why? They're not, certainly, their goal is not to reunify the two Koreas. So what is there? Are they surrogates, perhaps for another organization? I can't mention who, but is that what they're doing? They're doing all this saber rattling. Tell us about that.
Well, I think they are really that one unique case among nations today, and they are just a small, very insular dictator state. One family has run North Korea for decade after decade. What's interesting is what keeps it that way. You're right, the Korean War settled in 1953. Who would have thought that we'd be talking today about North Korea as a headline issue still, as we are? So it was settled, and the demilitarized zone was put in place there, and they were divided. South Korea, of course, would very much like to reunify at some point and hopes that will happen. North Korea, their goal is to maintain power, and with the latest is number three in the line, Kim Jong-un, and they think he's about 29 years old. He's not been raised in the world we know today. All he knows is that insular dictatorship of North Korea that his father and his grandfather passed down to him, and he is the one who is really saber-rattling. Now, what we think is going on in part is a struggle internally between Kim Jong-un and the North Korean military, as each feels each other out. Kim Jong-un only took over in, his father died in December of 2011. So these two sides are still trying to figure out really who has control over North Korea. The result of this is all the incredibly dangerous and overheated rhetoric that we've seen, and then the real actions. And let's not forget, you know, back in 2010, the North Korean Navy sank a South Korean naval ship, and 46 South Korean sailors died in that incident. And that same year, they shelled South Korea and destroyed, you know, about 70 homes and buildings with artillery shells. So they talk, but it's also their actions that are much, much more worrying than they were even a few years ago.
Well, again, I'm searching for the purpose. What would you say, in your opinion, and then we'll get to the Air Force's response, but what are they doing here? Is it just to draw attention to them? So every time they want to do something, here it is, they make a big announcement, and then it reminds Japan, China, and the rest of the world, this tinderbox, here they are, and they still are in charge. Is that what we're talking about? They just want to be, what was that Peter Sellers movie? The Mouse That Roared, wasn't it?
That's right. That was a charming movie. I wish this situation was anything like that. But you're right. It's about what's going on inside the country. So item number one, Kim Jong-un wants to stay in power. That's all he knows. He's been bred to that, trained to that. He wants to stay in power. They've always thought that the way to maintain that dictatorship is to cut off access to the outside world. But point two is Kim Jong-un wants to make sure he is in power and not his military generals. So there's a bit of a power struggle going on there. Point number three, the diplomats say that one reason North Korea acts out and makes the statements and carries out the actions and has worked to develop nuclear weapons, et cetera, is partly to give them negotiating leverage. And, of course, what makes all of this possible is that they have one big pal in the region, and that is China. China supplies them most of their oil, sends other things as well. And so, really, North Korea at this point is really a Chinese client state. So it's through the People's Republic of China that we have to look for any international leverage on North Korea.
Well, you covered that well. Folks, if you have a question for Dr. Grant or anything on the subject today, please call us at 877-573-7825. Once again, that's 877-573-7825. Now, I know that they had a failed launch of a satellite carrying rocket, as what I picked up on, but it really was a test of their ballistic missile technology. Could you just very briefly touch on that, please?
That's right, the rocket and the ballistic missile. It's the same type of technology. It's all about launching a heavy object into orbit and getting that object into the right place in the orbit. So countries will typically say, oh, we're doing a satellite launch. We want to place this satellite at a specific orbital location. But what this also means is if they can put a satellite or any object at all in that orbit, then they also have the ability to correctly target a ballistic missile. What's the difference between a satellite object and a ballistic missile? Well, they both go up to a specific point. The ballistic missile then tips over and comes back down. Of course, the satellite stays in orbit. So if you can get the satellite or the missile to point A, then you can have the same ability to bring a missile back down on a target. That's partly why it's so worrying. And I hope we'll talk in a minute here about some of the things that that the U.S. has done, or the U.S. military has done, to respond to North Korea's threatening moves.
Yes. In fact, I'm thinking about that right now as I'm looking here, that you had, at a previous program, you'd mentioned that China had stealth technology. Is that true?
Yes, they are working on stealth technology. They don't have as much as the U.S. does, but they are developing two different stealth fighters, and they claim they have some stealth drones in development as well.
Well, since China is a quote-unquote ally of North Korea, then does North Korea have an Air Force? And B, can this Can this then be given to the North Koreans, and could they develop a small but effective air force?
They do, and that's a possibility. China is still building out its own stealth force, so they don't have very many of these aircraft. They test flew them, one as recently as last fall, the other a little bit prior to that. So they're still in the early development phases, and it will be a little while until they have enough, and certainly until they would have enough. I wouldn't really expect China necessarily to give stealth fighter technology to North Korea. China is their ally, but in a way they're kind of the problem state as well. I mean, I don't think China is particularly thrilled always with what they're doing. The question is whether China is willing to really crack down on them or not. But one thing that we have as an advantage, and one way we've always addressed the tensions on the Korean Peninsula, is to make sure we have really overpowering air power from all the services, but led by the U.S. Air Force, in order to deter North Korea from taking any further actions, or if it comes to it, we expect our air power to be a big swing in the balance opposing any North Korean attacks.
Okay, let's talk about that air power that would respond to North Korea. What are we looking at? Stealth B-2 bomber, first of all, correct, could be called upon to fly missions over North Korea. What else is the Air Force putting out besides drones as far as the aircraft, and where are they located?
That's right. Well, the B-2, let's talk about that for a minute, because the B-2 stealth bomber carried out a really interesting mission back on March 28th, right in the midst of these tensions. Two B-2 bombers took off from Whiteman Air Force Base, which is located in Missouri near the town of Knobnoster. It's a beautiful Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower kind of, you know, lovely small towns, and that's where the B-2s are based. These two B-2 bombers flew all the way to South Korea, where they entered what the Air Force calls a range. That would be an area over the sea or over the land that's marked out for bombing practice. So these B-2s dropped dummy munitions on this South Korean range and then flew back, a return trip without landing, flew back to Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri. And so you say, hey, was that an accident? Were they planning to do that? Absolutely. This was a very intentional demonstration of U.S. air power. The B-2 is a bomber that can be armed with conventional weapons, but it also carries nuclear weapons. So that was a demonstration to North Korea and to China and really to all our allies in the region as well that the U.S. Air Force is completely able to respond to anything that North Korea might try to do. That was the point of that B-2 flight in March.
Well, in the vernacular, it's like having the big watchdog in the front yard. Hmm? You're not necessarily going to go breaking in there, right? Yeah.
Oh, I'd say in this case they took that big watchdog out and walked him down the block and let him bark quite a lot.
Made sure everybody saw it. Oh, I know. That was so cool. I love the response. It came from the administration. I don't have the exact quote, but and they handled that there. And you could tell that they were saying, oh, all right. This is off the record, of course, folks, but they were pointing out that, you want to do this? Well, we're going to show you folks something, and they absolutely did. And so now we have the B-2 bomber and fighters. If we were to scramble fighters, what do we have available in the Asian theater, and where would they come out of Guam? Is that the only place?
Oh, no, there are plenty of bases there for the fighters. And I want to add something, if you don't mind. Let me add something on the B-2 to tell you partly why this made such an impact. The last several air campaigns have started with attacks from the B-2. Okay, so starting back in 1999 in the air war over Yugoslavia, Kosovo, which was a NATO air war. Then, of course, the first night of Operation Enduring Freedom, Afghanistan. It's October 2001. The first bombers in are B-2s. Same thing with Iraqi Freedom 2 years later in 2003. So when the U.S. goes to war, out come the B-2s. So I think from the perspective of North Korea and of China to, you know, these B-2 missions really, really were a serious demonstration of we have the ability If you misbehave, we can target you. We can take out your targets. And if you ask the men and women who maintain and arm the B-2s out at Whiteman, and they'll if you say to them, you know, what's your mission? They say, well, our mission is to hunt down and destroy the enemies of America. And that's what that wing is prepared to do. Now, with them in that theater, you have another great set of capabilities. B-52s are often in the theater. They will fly from Guam really to all points of the compass. They may fly down to Australia, up towards Alaska, or out towards that restive area of North Korea. And this is what they call a bomber diplomacy, bomber presence missions, that are flown for two reasons. One, to show any potential adversaries that the U.S. is there, that they have the range and ability to reach out and strike a target at will. And the other part of the mission is just as important, and that's to assure our many allies and partners in the region that the U.S. is still very committed to the Pacific and will be there with military force and show up if a crisis erupts. So in addition to the bombers, there are a host of land-based fighters. We have a lot of forces in Korea still. The U.S. Army is there in force. Of course, the South Koreans have a pretty formidable army themselves, an Air Force as well. And we permanently base U.S. Air Force units on the Korean Peninsula, and they are primed to respond to any crisis or to a ground attack.
Now, the North Koreans will want, I'm sure would want to respond to a B-2 or B-52 attack. What do they have in defense for their country? What exactly do they have that could reach that?
Right. They might want to respond to a B-2 attack, but good luck with that. The B-2 is a high-altitude bomber. It's stealthy. It's designed to evade detection and tracking by radar-based surface-to-air missiles, and that's how countries defend their airspace, is with surface-to-air missiles. The B-2 is specifically designed to make that task really hard, so that if you see it, it's very fleeting. It's hard to find it and track it and aim at it and carry all that out before it's there and gone. They, of course, would respond, would try and respond with surface-to-air missiles and with fighters as well. So that's where the U.S. fighters really come into play. And we've seen F-22s deployed over in the Pacific region. The main bases, other than South Korea itself, are at Guam, which you mentioned. Also, the bases around in Japan, where we have basing agreements there, such as Kadena and Misawa. And then I think the feeling is that if a real crisis develops in the Pacific, maybe with North Korea, or maybe it's with other parties in the South China Sea, which is considerably south of the region we're talking about. Maybe it's China that's probing in that area. Anyway, if a crisis develops there, we have a number of very strong regional partners. Australia is one of the first that comes to mind, and we do see pretty frequent Air Force bomber or fighter deployments down to Australia. Another great regional partner is the Philippines. We don't have a permanent base there anymore. Bob, you probably remember hearing about Clark Air Force Base back from your days in the military.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's been closed for many years, but we maintain close relations with the Republic of the Philippines. And then, of course, Japan, a superb Air Force, a top ally. Japan's Navy participates very heavily with the U.S. Navy on a constant presence in the Western Pacific for missile defense. They have some very capable ships that literally rotate the watch with the U.S. Navy to keep a good missile defense umbrella over the region. Then, of course, we have the backup from Hawaii and Alaska, and usually at least one United States nuclear-powered aircraft carrier is in the Pacific as well, on what the Navy calls the Westpac cruise, providing additional presence and additional air power to that theater.
Well, this is similar to, this is a picket line, essentially, what it is. Mm-hmm.
It's a picket line, but a very flexible and mobile and agile one.
The sphere of influence for the U.S. in that area, because I could see that we are we are the umbrella protectors. We are. And that's cool. I don't have a problem with that. Would that also include Australia, our, as far as our sphere of influence and what we could help them with if for any reason they should be under a serious problem?
That's right. Australia very much included. And Australia is really a top partner. Australia's Air Force is a tremendous force, and you've met Australians in the past. They are ready to go get the job done. They're very keen to do whatever is necessary. It's a highly capable Air Force. They've bought a lot of new airplanes in the past several years. They're one of the few Air Forces internationally that's been able to do that. So they are an absolutely key partner. And they approach the problem much as we do. They have, of course, a big trading relationship with China and with many of the other countries in the region. We all want to see a peaceful trading relationship maintained, but the Australians are very blunt about the fact that they also have to maintain security in the Pacific. So they are a terrific, terrific partner for us, just as they were back in World War II, when you think about when Japan had chased the U.S. And the U.K. really back right down to the Australian bases. So they are just as important now as they were then, and they're a tremendous, small military, but very sophisticated, highly capable. So we could not function in the Pacific without both the good policy advice and the good military cooperation with Australia. They're tops.
Our guest today on Veterans Radio is Dr. Rebecca Grant. She's the president of IRIS Independent Research. Mm-hmm. Now, we've got about 3.5 minutes before our halfway mark. Could you just wrap up North Korea in general? Just give us something that we could look to as a mark for the future.
Right. Well, what we've seen in the last few months is really trying to keep North Korea in its box. The B-2 flights symbolize that. Of course, there are other military forces there doing the same thing. They're drawing out a line and saying, hey, North Korea, get back in where you need to be, cooperate more with the international system, and don't think you can cross the line of U.S. and allied military power in that region. You cross this line at your own peril. So the U.S. is saying with our allies, we will not stand for this type of behavior from North Korea.
Okay. Nina, I think we're going to go to our halfway mark a little bit early. Right now, you're listening to Veterans Radio here on WDEO 990 AM and on the webcast at veteransradio.net, www.veteransradio.net. We'll be right back with Dr. Grant. We'll be talking about drones and the effect of the sequester on our bomber fleet. So, you're listening to Veterans Radio. Stay tuned.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. It was Staff Sergeant Henry Irwin's job on the lead B-29 to drop a phosphorus canister as a marker when they reached the assembly area over enemy territory. Details after this.
It's time to find a job, but where do you start? Why not begin with the U.S. Air Force? We offer comprehensive job training, we help with advanced education costs, and we'll give you real job experience. So if you've got big dreams, let the Air Force help you get them off the ground. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on at airforce.com. Cross into the blue with the U.S. Air Force. No one comes close.
Irwin positioned the canister in the launch tube and pulled the pin at the pilot's orders. The flare dropped and then flew back into the plane. It exploded in Irwin's face, spewing flames just feet away from tons of incendiary bombs. Smoke filled the aircraft momentarily, blinding the pilot and co-pilot and putting the plane in a steep dive. Irwin dropped to his knees and, unable to see, felt for the canister. Although it was burning at 1,300 degrees, he picked it up, cradled it to his body, and began crawling to the cockpit. He yelled to the co-pilot to open the window and threw the flare out. The crew then turned its fire extinguisher on him and began to feed plasma into his arm. Doctors were sure he was going to die and transferred him to Guam. Major General Curtis LeMay recommended him for the Medal of Honor
and got authorities to expedite the award so it could be presented before he died. 1 week after the attack, LeMay presented the medal to Irwin at a bedside ceremony attended by the rest of his crew and his brother. Irwin surprised doctors by surviving. He was flown home to Alabama, where he was hospitalized for 2.5 years and underwent numerous operations. Henry Irwin died on January 16, 2002. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio and broadcasting from the Prairie House in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan on WDEO. With me as my guest today is Dr. Rebecca Grant. We all know who. She's been on the program in the past. She is the president of IRIS, Independent Research, a firm specializing in defense and aerospace research. Dr. Grant, second part, we want to talk about my favorite subject, drones. And what a lot of people that I question and talk with really don't have a lot of information about that. So, let's start with, as I look at President Obama in the past month, he sees a different threat that would require more drone use. And that it we're not going to have these large defense something of war or something like Bin Laden, where we were having these very large scale confrontations. There we go. Instead, it's going to be down to counter-terrorism. So that means that, in my feeling, that there's going to be lethal efforts with unmanned aircraft to take out certain individuals. So drones that started out as reconnaissance, and I believe that there was some low-level attacks with drones, but now are going to be targeting out as individuals, and there were a lot of folks that were not happy with that we are going out and killing people individually. Well, I don't have a problem with that. And by the way, my views are only up to me. That's not necessarily Veterans Radio. So let's talk about the narrow terror threat that President Obama sees and how he defends the use of drones and how is that all going to come into play. It's very broad. But Dr. Grant, tell us all about that.
Well, Bob, that's a great topic. Thursday, a week ago, the president gave a really major speech on national security, and he hasn't given very many of those during his time as president, and he gave it at the National Defense University at Fort McNair here in Washington, D.C., to an audience of military officers and students at the War College. The first part of the speech, he recaps our now decade-long war against terrorism following the 9/11 attacks. But it's in the second half of the speech that he says some really interesting things, and he's clearly trying to lay out and justify and explain more about his administration's use of drones. Now, he didn't start the drone programs by any means, and the ones that we usually talk about center on a very specific class. Those are what we call the medium-altitude drones. The two that we talk about are the Predator and its beefier cousin, the Reaper. They're both made by a company called General Atomics, and they are armed. They were armed more than 10 years ago, initially with the Hellfire missile. You probably had missiles like that around in the Vietnam time period. It kind of small, but real effective, fired off a helicopter. So they decided they could put a Hellfire on the Predator and have since put on some other weapons as well and onto the Reaper too. What's gotten controversial is the use of these unmanned aircraft to attack in Pakistan and in Yemen, to attack individuals who intelligence sources can verify are terrorists. I'll tell you first what isn't controversial about drones as much is when they're used to help defend American and other coalition troops in contact. Have you heard that phrase before, Bob, troops in contact?
No, I haven't.
Okay. It's, you know, it's a new phrase, but it's something you would, again, know from your service. That's when the bad guys are shooting at you and you're shooting back. They call that the formal term is troops in contact. So in those cases, it's been pretty common now to ask for close air support, often from a Predator or Reaper drone, to fire a missile at the enemy, get them to break off, give our troops a chance to move to better ground or regroup, and go ahead and press the attack. So whenever you have troops in contact, you bring all the forces of U.S. and coalition air power to help them out, and that's often a drone. We don't have any problem with that because the rules of war are pretty clear. Our guys are being shot at. Let's use drones or whatever else we have to give them some covering fire. The controversy is using the drones to watch for specific individuals who are known to be terrorists and then to use the weapons on the drones to take them out. That's where the controversy lies. What's interesting is that while this practice did not start with the Obama administration, the Obama administration has used it a lot and moved a lot of these strikes over to Pakistan and to Yemen, and that has begun to call into question, hey, what are we really doing here? So the president lays out his speech, and he says three very interesting things. One, he says, let's get this straight. These are very effective attacks. Okay, they are able to look very closely at the individuals. They are able to estimate if they fire a certain type of weapon, whether that's going to hit another part of a building, another part of an open compound, and what the potential collateral damage may be. So they're very precise, and they have been very effective. There have also been some unintended casualties, and I think quite a bit of regret about that. But for the most part, these drones have hit who they were intending to hit. So then the president goes on to say, you know, the second point he makes is, furthermore, these are legal attacks. He says these are part of legitimate self-defense. And, you know, he kind of hedges it a little and says, okay, just because the strike is legal doesn't mean that we like it or that we want to do this all the time. But nonetheless, you know, he's a lawyer by training, right? These are legal. And then I think probably the third thing he says that's so interesting, because it sounds so personal, really, the way he describes it. He says, look, you know, we got bin Laden by sending in SEAL teams who did a tremendous job against some high odds, and got bin Laden, got the guy they were looking for, and did that in Pakistan. But President Obama says, we can't do that every time. We cannot take the risk of putting in a SEAL team every time we're chasing one individual. And although he doesn't say it directly, the implication is clear. He says, look, it's just much better, much less risk to our forces, and much less risk of making a mistake to go ahead and use the very precise armed drones to carry out this policy. So it's an interesting description of where our policy is going with drones.
I see here that the CIA has taken over a great percentage of control of the drones. How does that affect the Air Force? Do they work together as far as targeting, hardware, etc.? Who's really in charge? CIA, Air Force, or what?
Right, and they tend to hand it back and forth. So 10 years ago, there weren't very many of these drones. There was just the Predator class, and the Predator is light. It's a light aircraft. It doesn't go very fast. The early ones weren't, you know, get in real trouble if there are heavy winds or ice, and they don't fly all that high. You know, they're a little rickety if you look at them. They painted that nice battleship gray. They look all serious, but, you know, that's a very light aircraft. The newer Reapers are a good bit heavier, but they're still not nearly as big as a fighter plane. So initially, there weren't very many of these, and they were used for surveillance. so when you're talking about surveillance, of course you've got the CIA and the intelligence community involved. The Air Force built several drones to use back in the Balkans in the Yugoslavia conflicts back in the 90s. And then, of course, the CIA had some as well. Well, along comes Afghanistan and Iraq, huge areas, and with lots of Americans and coalition forces involved and a huge need for surveillance. We build more and more and more drones. So what happens there is, as far as we can tell from public reporting, the CIA kind of has its stable of drones. The U.S. Air Force and the U.S. Army operate a number of the same Predator family systems that they use directly to support ground forces or special forces. So there's a big group out there. The bulk of them are in the hands of the Air Force and the Army, but the CIA apparently has a pretty sizable chunk of its own. And, you know, when one does these strikes, I think you bring a lot of resources to bear. You know, we all know we have surveillance satellites. We have other types of surveillance aircraft like the U-2. And you try to use all this intelligence to give you a really clear picture of who the person is that you're going after. Is that the right person? And to try to bring all that together to make the decision. But then it is often the surveillance drone that goes in, or in this case the armed drones, that goes in and actually does the strike.
Now, one of the last things, I don't know, we could talk for hours on this, and but one of the last things, I picked up a little article, and I mean it was a little article, about Hezbollah and being part of perhaps providing things like drones, maybe from Iran, I'm not sure, but to the Syrian rebels. What is the truth to that?
Yeah, there's a real concern there about the trafficking in drones, and I think it's safe to say that, you know, Iran has them and makes them. They've given them to Hezbollah, and I would not be surprised if they get distributed around the region, and there's no reason why some of those wouldn't end up over with Syria as well. But these are a different type of drone. They're much smaller and lighter. The difference is they'll be shorter range, lower altitude. So the Predator may be up there at the medium altitude, you know, you think kind of 20,000 feet or a little bit lower. These drones that Hezbollah may have in their possession are quite a bit smaller and lighter. But they do have some of the same capabilities on a much smaller scale, and that's the ability to fly out ahead, see what is over the next hill, do surveillance, and then in some cases to apply weapons to that. So it really changes the whole view of the battle space. And the drones give a lot more of the constant picture. We think about the video feeds that come from Predator. There are other ways to do that imaging as well. But certainly this means that not only ourselves, but potential adversaries and rogues and terrorists have the ability to see more of the battle space than they did in the past.
Okay, we're coming up on our third break. And John from Ypsilanti, we have not forgotten about you. We have a caller on the line. We'll get back with you right after this one-minute spot. And you folks, both Dr. Grant and John, is going to get a minute of dead air. Don't hang up. We'll be right back in 1 minute. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on WDEO. Yeah, we're back on Veterans Radio. I hope you all like that. Nah, that's always one of my favorite bumps. Yankee Doodle and on the line with me. As I reach over and bring him hot, is John from Ypsilanti. He wants to ask, with the White House undermine / disagree, which one with Rebecca Grant's comments in the first half. John, what comments were you talking about?
Well, her comments about, say, Korea and... just the general direction of the U.S. military. I don't know what President Obama's goals are. He doesn't share much. I'm not sure that he wants to attack anybody or defend the U.S. Against anybody. I just don't know what his goals are. And I would think that would change, it could possibly change a lot of Dr. Grant, right?
Yes, that's right. Well, why don't we stay with that and very quickly talk about what Dr. Grant's opinion, what would be the goals of North Korea, very, very quickly. Dr. Grant?
Yeah, the goals of North Korea, you know, they want to raise their international standing. I think a lot of this is about keeping Kim Jong-un in power. So just as the Soviet Union sometimes lashed out internationally when they are having internal political struggles, that's part of what we see going on in North Korea. This administration has been very clear about the Pacific and Asia being a priority. We were just talking about President Obama's speech from about 10 days ago, but the last big national security speech he gave was a year earlier in January of 2012. That's when he said, you know, we will rebalance our defenses towards the Asia-Pacific region. Of course, we're going to keep up counterterrorism, but they have made pretty clear, even with all the budget turmoil, that the presence in Asia-Pacific is quite important. North Korea is a big part of that. That's a big part of the reason that we'll keep forces there, as well as our many other interests in our relationships with our allies. So I think he's been pretty clear on that. And then with his speech from 10 days ago, he's also saying, hey, you know, we're going to continue the Afghanistan drawdown. But nowhere in this speech does he really retreat from his presidential authority to use the drone strikes in support of America's national interests. He seems pretty firm on continuing to do that.
Okay, well, John, thank you very much for that call. And we want to encourage anybody else out there who has a question for Dr. Grant or a comment, please call us 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825. Now we get down. Here it is, sequester, the bomber fleet. What's the status of the F-35? It was having some cost overrun problems that were reported earlier this year. And the B-52, and I believe it's the F-22. I mean, all of these things, the bomber fleet and sequester. Dr. Grant, what does all that affect us?
Well, Bob, exactly. Let's talk about sequester, which, if I'd had sequester on my SAT exam, I'm not sure I would have known what it really meant.
What's it mean?
You know, I'd have to fish out my dictionary to be really sure. But what it means today in Washington is that there will be automatic budget cuts taken out of the discretionary piece of the federal budget. So that's not Social Security, Medicare, but the things that run the departments, whether that's veterans or education or the Department of Defense. So because Congress cannot reach an agreement with the White House on budget reductions, their alternative, which neither side wanted to have happen, is sequester. Now, to the great surprise of all of us here, it's really gone pretty far. And so we've talked this morning about the B-2 flying over South Korea, show of force. We've talked about forces in the Pacific, the drones. And yet the reality is that starting in April, the U.S. Air Force stood down squadrons. That's kind of an Air Force term. What does that mean? That means saying, take this squadron, park your jets, don't fly. I have never in my about 20 years of working in this field seen this happen. And just looking at the list of some of the squadrons that were stood down is amazing. What's causing this is that the Air Force has to cut flying hours by the end of its fiscal year. You know, the government fiscal year ends in September every year. And so in order to save money because of sequester, they've said, we simply don't have the money to pay for the jet fuel and everything for these squadrons to fly. And here are some of the ones that are on the list, which is just amazing to me. The 28th Bomb Wing, which is B-1s, they stood down two squadrons of B-1s. Now, the B-1s have been very active. They support troops in Afghanistan. You know, if you're in Afghanistan and you're in trouble and you want a B-1 to fly over you at 2,000 feet, they'll do that. They've done that. The F-22 down at Langley, the 94th Fighter Squadron, was grounded on April 9th. The 94th was Eddie Rickenbacker's squadron from World War I. And these are frontline forces. There's no more proud squadron out there than the 94th. They are grounded with back to the bombers, the B-52s, one squadron from the 2nd Bomb Wing, which is down in Barksdale, Louisiana, stood down on April 9th as well. And the list goes on and on. We have a unit called the 48th Fighter Wing, which is based at RAF Lakenheath. They have three squadrons. One is an F-15C squadron. They do air-to-air and air defense in Europe. And the others are F-15E squadrons. Those are fighter-bomber squadrons. And you'll find men and women in those squadrons who have 1,000 hours of combat from Iraq and Afghanistan. The 48th Fighter Wing has stood down both of its F-15E squadrons, grounded, just wheels not turning, pilots not flying, maintainers not keeping the jets in working order. I have just never seen anything like this. And the real problem is that if something pops up 6 months from now or a year from now, you'll have planes and crews that have not been trained and ready and that are not ready to go to war.
Now, there was a time when B-52s, 24/7, were in the air. There always was somebody here going to the fail-safe position. Has that been changed?
Yes, that changed back in the early 90s. They took it off the 24-hour alert, but they've stayed in a level so that you can spin them up to a certain level of alert. So maybe they're ready to go in an hour. Maybe they need 24 hours notice. Maybe you want them on a 15-minute alert. That can be dialed up and down. But the trouble is, if you take out, you know, we only have four B-52 squadrons total. And if you ground two of them, you've got half your force that aren't flying and aren't current, and air crews lose what they call currency within about 120 days. So that means if they're really ready, they want these men and women to fly a certain number of hours each month on a regular basis. So you're not walking out to your B-52 at steaming, hot Barksdale or frozen over Minot and saying, hey, I haven't even started the engines on this thing in 6 months. I wonder if I still know how to fly it. You know, that's not the way the Air Force works. But that's what sequester has done to the Air Force. It's hitting the other services as well, Army, Navy, Marine Corps. But that is what it is doing to the Air Force. We have squadrons that have stopped flying.
Now, in the past programs, when you've been on our program, we have talked about my favorite, my absolute favorite airplane, the B-52, and it was going to continue. They were going to be refitted, and perfectly be around for another 30 years. And because of sequester, has that changed?
The B-52 is staying in the force, but, you know, what's difficult about this is if you have an older car and you take it out and you run it periodically and change the oil and do regular maintenance, it'll go just fine for you. But you leave it parked out in your driveway for several months at a time, and do you think it's going to run the same way? So I worry about the B-52 with that. So it's not only just the air crews losing their currency. And then here's the other thing. So let's say sequester goes away, which we hope it does. Probably won't know till fall, and it may last longer than that. But whenever it does end, you're suddenly looking at maybe if you have 100 B-52 pilots, there may be 50 of them who haven't flown as much as they should have. So to try to get them all back to the training level they're supposed to be at, you've got to fly a lot of hours. You've got to be wearing those B-52s out. And the cost and the time that it takes to regain that level of proficiency, you know, Bob, it's unprecedented. We have not seen this happen, and we're not in a good place to judge the risks that we're running.
Without your political, because I know that we want to keep this as straight as we can just towards military issues as far as hardware, What about the F-35? And it had experienced huge cost overruns. There was talk about cutting back on the fleet. We have a couple minutes. Tell us about the F-35, which seems to be the plate of the... And I know that you promoted that for all the air forces to buy. The F-35. Is that Grumman? I can't...
Grumman is now part of Northrop Grumman, and they are a major supplier on the F-35. They make radar and center section and several other pieces of it. But the prime contractor is Lockheed Martin, and the F-35 is the replacement fighter for the Air Force. It needs about 1,700, also for the Navy and for the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps is buying the jump jet version. There's actually been some good news on the F-35 this week. It has grown in cost since the program was started over a decade ago, but they just did a cost estimate which showed that the cost growth had stopped. Actually, it's coming in only 1% lower, but the good news is it's not increasing. And the better news is the Air Force has decided to go ahead and declare combat capability along with the Marine Corps in about 2 years from now, and that's a great step forward. That means they'll have enough jets out there so that if I'm on your program, Bob, in the year 2016, we can talk about the F-35 Lightning, the first combat units being ready to go off and deploy and go to war if they need to. So that's a good sign of progress for F-35.
Okay, Dr. Grant, thank you very much for being on our program. Once again, the time goes by very, very fast. We've got about 30 seconds. Could you very quickly give me a website that people can go and get more information?
Certainly. Check out www.irisresearch.com, and we'll have a new publication up there talking about fighter aircraft in the Pacific.
Okay, that's IRIS. There we go, www.irisresearch.com. Dr. Graham, thank you very much for being on the program, and, of course, you'll be back.
Bob, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, Veterans Radio right here. We got the countdown, 6-5. So until next week, when you'll be dismissed.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light, what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly
views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.